Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We thought the earthquake in Haiti was as bad as it gets. Now we've seen hurricane, deadly cholera, riots. It's brutal to live with, hard to watch. Surely harder still if you're an exquisitely tuned Haitian-American artist, writer, looking out on the country of your birth, your youth, your cousins right now. We'll go to Port-au-Prince today, and we'll talk with the celebrated Haitian-American writer, Edwige Dantika, this hour On Point Crisis in Haiti. And a conversation with Edwige Dantika. You can join us. What are you seeing in, hearing from Haiti right now? Edwige Dantika joins me in the studio, born in Haiti, came to the U.S. at age 12. Still young, but already celebrated, she won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 2007 for her work of memoir and social criticism, Brother, I'm Dying. She won a 2009 MacArthur Genius Grant. Her latest book is Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work. She's also out with a new children's book, 8 Days, a story of Haiti that brings us the earthquake through the eyes of a child. Edwige Dantika, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's just listen to a little bit of what's coming out of Haiti these days. Here is this is Virginie Corrivier from Doctors Without Borders saying yesterday that her group expects the number of cholera cases to keep rising until the end of this month.
The cholera is like a mountain. It builds up and builds up, and then it descends. So the epidemiologists say that the peak is going to be towards the end of this month. Here in Cité-Soleil, we have attended to 3,000 people in the last week.
Like a mountain that builds up and now it's coming down. And here's a young Haitian woman living in a tent camp telling Reuters last week she's fearful of contracting cholera, doesn't trust the sanitation of her surroundings.
We are very scared of cholera. They have put this tank of water there for us and told us that it has been treated. Since I have no other choice, we drink it.
Edwige Dantika, you hear these reports and see them along with all of us. You know this country better than most here. How do you look out right now on what's going on? We thought the earthquake was just about as bad as anything could be handed down, and now cholera on top of it, riots because people are worried about where it came from. What are you looking at in the country of your birth today?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, if it's a country where you still have family, as Haiti is, mm-hmm. it's always immediately personal because people are calling mm-hmm. with those same concerns that you're hearing. And we even had a family member come most recently who talks about really the silent panic of people, but also the greater panic that this is something that is spreading. We've talked so much...
The cholera,
mm-hmm. yes. And we've talked so much about the resilience of Haitian people since this earthquake happened.
Mm-hmm. And we have seen it.
Yes, and we've asked so much of them. And I think on some level, it was starting... The perception was going that they can suffer more than other people, that they can bear more than other people. But the cholera points to something fundamental, in that there's, even before the earthquake, this was an issue, and that there's such a great need for sanitation and clean water, and especially in this moment of crisis. And people need also to feel like, and I think that's why you were having the different uprising, they need to feel like they're being heard and that something will be done about their situation.
The riots, of course, that we've seen in a couple of Haitian cities in the last few days, purportedly from people who think that the cholera was brought in by UN troops who came in back in 2004. You know, here's the river, there's the troops, they're from South Asia, it's a South Asian strain, and so they're in the streets. Others saying this is being manipulated. Do you understand what's going on? Is people really take to the streets over this?
Well, we have to, I mean, I don't think the fact that it comes from outside of Haiti is that easily dismissible, because they have traced back to the place where the camp was, and perhaps it's due to improper disposal of the waste. And mm-hmm. and there, you know, scientists, you know, even Dr. Paul Farmer, who is comes out of here, he's encouraged further investigation of that. I mean, it's important that the source of it is found, and perhaps that can lead to more restraint of it. Perhaps is this being manipulated? You know, elections are coming up and so forth. But I do think people have reached a level of you know, nubuque, as the walls of Port-au-Prince say. You know, people are really tired, and a lot has been asked of them. They've been through an earthquake. They've been through a hurricane that could have really, if it had been worse, wiped out.
Hurricane Tomas.
Yes, and now they're going through cholera, and I think it's, you know, what you're seeing, these new developments of people saying, you know, we're tired, nubuque.
Nubuque, is that what it means? We're tired
nubuque.
Enough?
Yes, kinda? And if you know, on the walls of Port-au-Prince, all over the city, you see it, nubuque, along with all the posters for the candidates. There.
Presidential and other elections coming
yes.
up on November 28th. Nubuque, we're tired. I mean, Haiti, maybe above all countries, lately raises this question of how much humans can take.
Exactly. And I think sometimes it's great and people are extraordinarily resilient. And it's a cliché in part because it is true. But I think every person, every population has its limits. And I think we might be reaching, we're seeing in these uprisings a sort of boiling point to the limits of this resilience that people have been asked to bear so much.
You are among the most prominent of the Haitian diaspora in this country. There are many in the United States and around the world. How do your friends in the diaspora deal with this? Your cousins, maybe your siblings, mother, father are there suffering through this. You're here in the United States. You write eloquently. You write with exquisite insight. And yet there's that barrier of water between you.
Well, I think one of the sort of the when people talk about, often they talk about friction in the diaspora, between the diaspora and people who are left back home. I mean, I see it as a kind of family affair. You know, a lot of us are here and must remain here so that others for each family in Haiti, you have someone in the diaspora who is support them, especially if you come from a poor family, from poor families like I do. I come from a poor family.
And there's no question, billions and billions go back to Haiti from Haitians abroad.
Yes, and a lot of people have to leave so that they can make life possible for themselves and for the people who are there, you know, who are behind. And there is it's sort of an umbilical cord that's tied, and especially in moments of crisis where people in the diaspora, we feel closer to our country and we suffer along with it. Nothing like the actual suffering of people who are in the front lines and the danger, but there's still that inevitable connection And for a lot of families, one can really not exist without the other, and that their families in Haiti, that were it not for the branch of their families here, would not be able to even support themselves to the extent that they are.
To live.
That they are, yes.
So there's very material aid coming in from the diaspora, from people just like yourself. There's moral support, though that must come tinged sometimes with guilt at being across the water from all that suffering. In your new book, Concrete Dangerously, you're quoting Camus a lot. I mean, you're an artist. You're bringing together your very real observation of what's going on. At the same time, you're dealing with the philosophy of life, of suffering, of struggle. I mean, is there for Haitians? Is there a break point in here? What does that even mean when you're on an island and you know there's a lot of aid from abroad, but there's not a bridge?
Well, it's interesting because the former prime minister of Haiti, who has spent some time in Boston in this area, talks about connecting Haiti with the Camus story of Sisyphus, which is the sort of the myth of the person who rolls this rock up the hill all the time, and
again,
then knowing that it's going to go down, and what Camus says in that is that you hope that Sisyphus is happy in the process, because it's an eternal process of going up and down a hill. And sometimes there's this, you know, there is that parallel with Haitian history. And what we, you know, the struggle continues to be how we get up that hill and stay up that hill.
Is there a point at which a nation just says we can't roll it up there? anymore? I mean, it sounds terrible. It's not human nature. I know we always come back in some way, but if any country's been tested, been brought to that line, that limit, it may be Haiti.
Well, the extraordinary thing, too, about Haiti is that with all that, I mean, Haiti's been through some very difficult moments before. I mean, this is probably one of its most difficult. But you've seen that as long as things get a little better, people get hopeful. I mean, there will be some variation of Christmas in Haiti, for example, because there are children, because there is love in spite of all of that. And people create art, they sing songs. And that's one of the most amazing things about Haiti, that once it's given even a tiny chance, it advances. People advance. People have a great entrepreneurial spirit. They do a lot with very little, because they've, as a nation and as individuals, people have had to rely on their common sense, on their ingenuity. And it's a place that if we get a little break, you know, progress is made, and we have seen it before.
Do your Haitian relatives say that even to you? You're a writer, you're an artist, you know, create art, sing songs, or do they say, get down here with some help for us?
Well, we do both. I mean, I think a lot of, whether people are doctors or they're teachers, you end up doing both, and that's sometimes people will say, you know, for all the song that's sung and all of this, but Haiti's never sort of divorced the two. People have always sung their songs and protest sometimes in celebration and mourning. They've painted their paintings. They've created their art. It's always been part of it. I don't think one has to be divorced from the other. We can do both.
Here's sounds of rioting, which has broken out in Haiti in recent days. Some Haitians blaming UN peacekeepers for introducing cholera, they're charging, into the country. Here's an AP report from yesterday.
Anger spilled onto the streets in Haiti's second largest city, Cap Haïtien, protesting quickly turning to rioting that continued well into the night. One person was killed in an exchange of gunfire between UN soldiers and protesters just outside the city.
And here from northern Haiti, one man talking to the BBC about the cholera epidemic that has been spreading day after day.
We are getting together to pray, as no one has come to help us. Several people who were infected here have died, so prayer is the only answer that we have left.
Haitians, Haitian Americans, we're eager to hear from you in this hour and from all who have watched the suffering of this country for a long time, and particularly in these last months. We're at 800-423-8255. Edwige Dantica is with me in the studio, and joining us right now from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, is Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. She has covered this earthquake from the very earliest days. She was the first to interview the Haitian president, René Préval, after the disaster. She also happens to be a close friend of Edwige Dantica, who is here with me in the studio. Jacqueline Charles, thank you very much for joining us from Port-au-Prince.
Hi, thank you.
What's the latest on the cholera, Jacqueline?
Well, I can describe to you what I'm looking at right now. I'm actually in Port-au-Prince, where some teams from the Ministry of Public Work are on a main road not far from the Prime Minister's office. There is a dead man in the street who apparently is someone that had some mental problems. With people on the streets are telling us that he died of cholera. And this is what has now happened in this country. There's a stigmatization that has happened. And basically, individuals who are dying of this disease are being abandoned in hospitals. They're being abandoned, you know, on streets, because people just don't know what it is, and there is this fear. As of today, there are 1,000 people who have died, at least that's what we know of, and thousands more have been hospitalized with suspected cholera.
The reports now that it's spread a bit to the neighboring Dominican Republic, what are you hearing about what scale this could reach? Is this just the beginning? Could it be peaking? What do you know, Jacqueline?
Yeah, what we have been told from the very beginning is that cholera has to peak, and that it has not yet peaked. It just arrived in the capital last week. We're being told in some of the communities where it initially broke out that it did reach a peak. For instance, I wrote recently about Grand Saline, which is this fishing village which had one of the highest cases of cholera, when it was initially confirmed, that's what it was. And what we're being told there is that the number of cases have diminished since. But given the sanitary or unsanitary conditions that exist, you know, in Haiti, especially in the capital and some of the other larger cities, I think everyone is just watching this and waiting to see what happens. We're also being told that the cases also increase with rain. And, you know, this is a country that it has two rainy seasons, and when there's flooding, there's always disaster, and this is the latest one.
Jacqueline, you've covered this for such a long time now, since the earthquake, and I know that you're close with Edwige Danticat, who is with us in the studio here in Boston. We're as interested in your conversation with her as almost as in the news itself. Edwige, please say hi to Jacqueline.
Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, Edwige.
I wanted to ask you what's are there any developments in terms of the UN with that connection, because apparently the people, the uprising in Okap and Cité Soleil had a lot to do with people's perception that this started with the UN.
The charge being that it was UN soldiers from Nepal who were in a particular area of Haiti, and that maybe that was the origin of the cholera. I've seen all kinds of comments on that. You know, maybe, maybe not. Jacqueline, what do you hear?
Well, you know, we have to go back to the official report that the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, put out, where they said, look, we cannot say exactly who was responsible and where this has come from. And one of the things that happened early on after that report was released was the Haitian government reminded Haitians that we have been the victims of stigmatization in the past, especially for H as it responds to HIV and AIDS, and we have paid dearly for that. We saw our tourism industry basically just die, and even till this day, you know, Haitians are asked the question about whether or not you've been to Haiti, and if you have, you can't give blood. And so what they've called on, you know, Haitians here in this country is to remember that, and that, let's not jump to conclusions and assert blame. But yes, the reality on the ground is that cholera is here, people are dying, we are now counting the dead in a country where people die every day, and we have not counted. And people are looking for a place to put their anger. And so I think what happened in the city of Cape Haitian, what happened in Inch, is that what you saw. But were those protests about cholera, were they about anti-UN sentiments? There's a lot of questions about that. Remember, we're in an election period, and you have frustrations that are running high, and basically all you have to do is, you know, light a match. A lot of people are surprised that this place has not blown, given 10 months after the earthquake and the conditions in which people are still living. So I'm not quick to say that what happened in Cap Haïtien, Cape Haitien, the second largest city, was because of the cholera or, you know, the anti-UN sentiments. I think that some people have been building on it, but just from some conversations that I'm having, we're hearing that it may not have had anything to do with that at all. But, you know, today, you know, I think the message that people are trying to get out, not so much about, you know, who do you blame for it, but we have an epidemic. And how do you address this epidemic? How do you, you know, contain it? How do you prevent people from dying? You know, one of the few silver linings in this is that as the number of individuals go into the hospitals, you're seeing more and more of them exit alive as opposed to dead. But we still have dead bodies.
And hospitals which themselves have become centers of cholera infection. Jacqueline, you know Edwige well. You were born in Turks and Caicos, I understand, but your mother's Haitian. You both know this country very well. I'll ask Edwige, but let me ask you first, how are Haitians coping with this? What's the psychology, the frame of mind with this blow after blow?
You know, it's everybody, you know, in terms of Haiti, it all goes back to God. You know, for Haitians, they hold on to God, they hold on to Jesus, they hold on to their religious belief. And when you, you know, when you talk to Haitians, this is what you get. I just spoke to this one woman, you know, and asking her about cholera and how she feels, what is her frame of mind, this very same question. And she says, well, you know, but God wants it, you know, that this is God's work. And so for Haitians, you know, living in this country year after year, seeing the recent disasters, four hurricanes back to back, an earthquake, food riots, you know, now cholera, you know, the way that they hold on to hope is that belief. I think for us on the ground, it's like when you get to a place where you no longer have hope, it's like you might as well die. And so there's this constant battle of not allowing yourself to get to that point. But one has to wonder, you know, what next, how much more.
Edwige Danticat with me here in the studio. I mean, you're the literary figure here. Put your fingers on the pulse. You listen to people. You talk with people there. You're watching. What about the frame of mind of Haitians and under all this? Whoa.
Well, I mean, I think Jacqueline is absolutely right. People are so used to being on their own, you know, from the time that you are born practically in Haiti, it's you and God. And larger, you know, there are larger forces that affect your life for ill, but people have a great faith, but also, you know, not so much perhaps in the bigger powers, but they also have great faith in each other. So people will say it's this person or that person and God to me, or someone who, you know, but people really rely heavily also on one another.
But I'm looking at your children's book here, where the young boy is trapped in the rubble for 8 days. The book is called 8 Days, A Story of Haiti. And during that time, you know, after he comes out, he relates how he, in his mind, he played. And he played in his imagination through those kind of connections. They had each other. You know, he describes playing with friends in the, down at the barber shop and with his family. But what's absolutely devastating about the book is you realize that so much of what he's describing that sustained him in the rubble is now gone when he emerges from it. I mean, Haitians may have relied on one another, but those they relied on may be suffering, dying from cholera right now.
But a community, you know, whether it's spiritual community or just the community of people you find yourself around, remains extremely important. And on some level, the Haitian American community or the diaspora is part, sort of an extended sense of that community. And I think that's probably how Haitians have lasted for so long, with their faith, with their community, and with their reliance on their imagination and their power, their ability, in spite of everything, to still conceive and imagine a better future. People will always say to you, you know, if I don't live to see something, I hope my child does. And that's why, you know, children, you know, are so important to families in Haiti. And children are so important because I think that's, people live their entire lives hoping that even if they've had a very horrible and miserable life, at least they'll try to fight, they'll struggle so that their children can have a better future, like everybody everywhere else.
Those children facing the same disease. We see the pictures of children dying as well now. Edwige Danticat is with us. Create Dangerously is her latest work. And Jacqueline Charles with the Miami Herald joins us from Port-au-Prince. You can hear the sound of the siren there. Let's go to our listeners. Maggie in West Hartford, Connecticut. You're on with Edwige Danticat and Jacqueline Charles.
Yes, hi. I've been involved in helping with going to Haiti twice a year for about 13 years, and I would never stop. I see them as having the medicine that we need, and likewise we're trying to help out. We're packing up now as I speak to help a medical team go down next week.
What do you mean they have the medicine we need, Maddie? What do you mean?
Okay. When you go to Haiti, you come back and you see your own culture in a whole different way. Our young people are so depressed and anxious. Everybody's so nervous. You go there and you see their faith and their strength. I see these different teams that we're working together, and you've got hardcore Republicans, very liberal Democrats. It doesn't matter. We're all on the same page. There's something in Haiti that if I go there 30 more years, I might begin to understand that what they have for us. I really feel strongly we're different pieces to a puzzle.
And yet it can look, you can make the argument, this is a failed state, Maggie, that you're finding inspiration in.
Yeah, I don't understand it. it's just amazing to me that you have people go there and see, and just, I can't wait to go back, almost universally. And my son has lived there for a year. He's going back, and it's not based on, gee, what success we've had. Somebody, one of the doctors said, can you pick one person that we actually helped this trip? And we'd say no. It's like, okay, let's go back again. You know, just, and I know we are helping. It's a long term. The key is the relationship which we have now with them.
Maggie, good luck on your trip back to Haiti. All right. Edwige Danticat, there's an American going to help Haiti, not certain on any given trip how many people are helped, but coming back with a kind of inspiration and sustenance from what she finds there. How do you take that on board? What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, without idealizing poverty, you know, I think people do find inspiration in the strength of people, which is what we've been talking about. And I think it goes back to people who have really always have to be self-reliant, who've had to really... The business of survival takes a lot of time and energy, and I think a lot of people are involved in that in Haiti, and perhaps others find inspiration in that.
Jacqueline, you're there in Port-au-Prince. You're seeing what's going on firsthand. We're hearing the sirens behind you even as we speak. I mean, is it sacrilege to take inspiration from Haiti in the midst of all this suffering?
I don't know if it's sacrilege. I think what ends up happening is if you think about us living in the United States, you know, we give our money to charities, we go out on Thanksgiving Day and we feed the homeless, but we really don't have a connection between the act of what we're doing and the difference that it may be making in somebody's life. And I think what happens in Haiti, whether the person comes on their own or with a church group or they come with an NGO, is they feel that given the amount of poverty, the amount of need that's here, that somehow that they are really, truly making a difference. And this is what I see, you know, on the ground, is that people come here, and I don't know if it's falling in love with the place or falling in love with this ability to help or think that they're making, you know, that they're making a difference. But I think it's good and it's bad. I think that it's been good from an individual perspective, because you're giving back and you are touching an individual's lives. But I think that when you look at it on a global scale, what has happened in this country has basically been international band-aid. And that, you know, at the end of the day, there's very little, if anything, that is sustainable. And so when you have a situation like cholera today, you're treating the symptom rather than the cause of the problem. And so today it's cholera. Tomorrow, what will it be? It's going to be something else.
Jacqueline Charles, stand by there in Port-au-Prince. Edwige, there's clearly an inspiration. We hear it articulated by our caller. At the same time, there seems to be a real danger of looking to Haiti in its suffering for a kind of moral uplift. I mean, this is real suffering. This is right now. People are dying of cholera right now.
Absolutely. I mean, and we would not be able perhaps to have helped as many people without outside help. And the great thing, I mean, in this aspect of the dilemma, the crisis from the earthquake to this moment, the great thing that I've seen emerge out of it is also a greater commitment from Haitians outside of Haiti, from Haitians in the diaspora. We have probably more doctors here in Massachusetts probably than you have in all of Haiti. Haitian American doctors.
80% of Haitian professionals are abroad, but is that a good thing?
Well, it's not a good thing for those people and their families. It was a necessary thing. It's probably something that's helping to sustain their families back home. But the great thing that goes along with this caller is that you also have Haitian Americans, Haitians from Canada, others who have gone back and also contributed to this, and they were able to bridge that gap that you have between. Only outsiders going in, and that's something that's been wonderful to see more visibly in this element, this moment in Haiti.
Let's go to our listeners. Johnny is calling. Hi, Johnny, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. It's very fortunate that right now we're dealing with all those things in Haiti, the cholera and everything. But the only thing I could say is right now we don't really have, like, good leaders. And then also we, all Haitian, we don't really have trust in each other. So I'm sorry to say that, but I'm pretty sure the worst yet to come. The only thing that's going to happen in Haiti that's going to be really bad is, like, a civil war, because the way things are going, it's really bad. In Haiti right now, how could you be, like, tomorrow it's going to be 207 years since we fought the French, and then we defeated them at the such a war. So right now, look at us. We are the poor country in the hemisphere. It's because we all Haitians. We don't really do what we have to do. We shouldn't be at this situation right now. It's very bad for all the people that living down there. I'm Haitian. I love Haiti to death, but the worst had to come. And I'm pretty sure they're pointing at the UN saying that they are the one who brought the cholera in Haiti, which is, most of us know it's a lie, because we didn't really have sanitation stuff, and right now that's reaping the consequences of our mistake.
Yet, in at least the last century, though, Haiti hasn't had cholera, but now there it is. I mean, Jacqueline, you hear Johnny, Haitian in the U.S., he says, we lack good leaders, we don't trust each other, the worst is yet to come, maybe even civil war. How do you respond, Jacqueline?
I'm an optimist. I am not a pessimist, and I think that as Haitians that we need to remain positive in terms of this country. That if suddenly you become this pessimist and think that the worst is yet to come, when given all that we've experienced, I mean, who would have imagined an earthquake of the caliber of January 12th and 300,000 dead? And yet, Haitians remain resilient, and they remain calm, and even till this day. And despite what happened in Cape Haitian on Monday,
the riots,
it still was not of the magnitude that you've seen elsewhere. So I think that, as Haitians, we have to remember that this is a country that is still undergoing this experiment called democracy. We are still emerging out of dictatorship. And while a lot of for this to be a much better functioning nation, I think that we also need to be patient. But we, as Edwidge said, as Haitian Americans and Haitians living outside of Haiti, that we need to give back, that we need to bring our expertise and our knowledge that we've gained, and we need to continue to support our family and friends that are here and help this nation mature where it needs to be.
Jacqueline, stand by. I mean, here's a web comment, Edwige from Zeno. It says, I have to say that if the same conditions were to occur in America, the violence would be stunning. However, the Haitians must have learned through abject catastrophes, political and physical, they've behaved with great humanity. It's stunning to see. Jacqueline says she's an optimist. Now, as a writer, you may be an optimist, but as a writer who looks deeply, you must also understand the pessimistic side of human nature. You heard it there in our Haitian caller, Johnny, 207 years and still looking at this. How do you deal with that side of the Haitian challenge?
Well, even in Johnny's comment, he reminded us that tomorrow is the 207th anniversary of the Battle of La Vertière. And imagine how impossible it must have seemed to the men and women, and there were women who were fighting this battle 207 years ago, who had been enslaved, who had nothing, who were really fighting against the most powerful army in the world. And yet that battle was won, and that's how the nation was created. So even in his statement,
yes,
I think there's still the optimism that looking back on history also brings us. I mean, we've never had perhaps a moment this difficult, but I too have to keep hoping, because when you stop hoping, you die. And the people down there, 1.5 million of them on the street, are hoping for something better. And I'm curious to hear from Jacqueline. Perhaps we'll get a sense to talk about it, what these elections, what that is feeling like in the middle of all this.
We'll go to the elections, but I have to ask you, I mean, those were brave men 207 years ago. They were up against a great power. They won independence for Haiti, men and women. But can you imagine that they would have thought 2 centuries later their independent, heirs would be facing this?
Well, the person with the web comment also had a very interesting point. If we take, when we talk about failed states and we talk about this independence, if we take race out of it, if we take this notion of other out of it, imagine any country having all these obstacles consistently, I mean, would we have a different outcome? I mean, this country's had to overcome a great deal. And its hope at its core are the people we don't hear about all the time, are these people who in the tent cities iron their little kids' clothes so they can go to a school.
Yes, we see it. It's
and
incredible.
A field. And I think those are the people who will build Haiti, the people who exercise that hope, manifest it every single day.
Here's the other side of that compassion theme. This is from Greg. A web comment says, it's time to tell Haiti to take care of itself. We've been helping that country for the better part of a century. No good has come of it. Tell the Haitians that we'll be here when they're ready to form a good government, be productive citizens of the world, but we aren't going to support corruption and riots anymore. What do you say to that, Edwige?
Well, Greg, this is a country that's been trying to take care of itself for all these years. And always there's the intrusion of foreign powers. There's the, you know, policies that, you know, recently President Clinton apologized for what he termed himself pretty much destroying the rice harvest in the breadbasket of Haiti. So it's not
with imports of agricultural goods.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's not for lack of trying. Haiti has been trying to take care of itself all those many years.
Joseph is calling. Joseph, you're on the air. Thanks for your call. What do you see?
Thank you. Good program, like you always. And Haiti, the problem Haiti, most people always talking about the Port-au-Prince. Port-au-Prince is not all about Haiti.
Port-au-Prince, so the capital city. Yeah.
I'm listening to the radio every single day to hear exactly what's going on in my country.
Mm-hmm.
So, upset on Sunday. So, there's 1,000 people die about the cholera. Not more than 1,000 people die. Mm-hmm. 1,000 people is died. That's the people went to the hospital.
Yeah.
People who doesn't have opportunity to go to the hospital, they just bury them without no car.
Joseph, what do you say to our commenter who says it's time to tell Haiti to take care of itself? What do you say to that, Joseph?
I'm going to come in with my comment first. After that, I answer your question.
Yes.
So the problem is, in Haiti, the witness said, and the Mirabal, that's located in Plateau Central, we have some UN down there, get the mobile toilet, drop it in the river, Latibonit River. Latibonit River, that's a big river, come from Santo Domingo, go way down to the west.
Right.
So that's the reason they got the cholera. So the government high, you don't want to talk about that. The United Nations try to hide that. They don't want the world know about that. When I told my client what happened about the toilet, the dump in the river, a lot of people drink that water of the river in the ground. That's why we have the cholera. Nobody don't want to talk about that. The government don't want to talk about that. The UN don't want to talk about that. Because the reason is, Haiti is not Afghanistan. Haiti is not Iraq. Haiti needs some UN or some power want to help agriculture. Just rebuild the school.
So,
just rebuild the world.
And Joseph, right there, I have to ask you, respond then to our correspondent who says it's time to tell Haiti to take care of itself.
Yeah, that's true, because Haiti used to take care of itself on the ICE government. What, you got 2 Bushes coming, give them the coup d'etat back. That's why we have all kinds of problems in Haiti. And remember, 1994, we always have the election, the first democratic election. After 7 months, Haiti was like, everybody was having a good time. Everybody was having try to make a living. You have the bushfire, get the coup d'etat. After that, the President Clinton restored the ex-president back.
Yeah.
Good election. We have Aristide back. You have the Bush Jr. coming. He gave him another coup d'etat. Back this country 100 years back. Why you think? That's
yep.
Kind of democracy we're talking about in the world.
There's a lot of history here, and it's not all 200 years old, Jacqueline. I mean, foreign governments, international aid groups have sent about $3.5 billion in humanitarian aid in 10 months since the earthquake. And then you hear our caller say, or our correspondent online say, it's time to tell Haiti to take care of itself. Is there any way that can happen, Jacqueline?
Well, first of all, let me just say something to you. I arrived here on January 13th, just hours, you know, after this earthquake had hit on January 12th. And what I like to say to people is that when the international community finally arrived in Haiti, they did not come with 300,000 body bags. So one has to ask who buried those 300,000 people, or if you think it's 200,000 or however number you think actually died during this earthquake, who buried them? You know, it was the Haitians. It was, and a lot of them were Haitian women who had never seen a dead body or seen them in the conditions that they were, and they were the ones who took the trucks and drove the trucks that were carrying the dead bodies. Today, who is picking up the dead bodies of the people who are dying of cholera? It is Haitians that are doing it. Yes, this is a country with a lot of challenges and with a lot of problems, but I, you know, in terms of, you know, what Edwige was saying, that you can't just look in terms of Haiti and the governance issues, but you also have to look at international policy and ask, why is it after years of investments in this country that we're still dealing with the same issues over and over again? The $3.5 billion that has been sent, it did not directly go to the government. It is in the hands of NGOs. Today, there's between 10,000 and 20,000 non-governmental organizations in this country, many of them working at cross purposes. And just to give you an example, I recently went to a community where 120 homes were being built, and I was surprised. And these are homes without toilets, but I was like, wow, 120 homes, concrete homes that are being built. And then before I left, I asked the proprietor, by the way, how much did you pay for the land? And she says to me, land? What land? Land belongs to God. So an NGO has come in and built 122 homes on land. The government knows nothing about it, no government permission. So imagine if everybody can go and build 120 homes without permission, without purchasing land, we would not have 1.5 million people in tents. So I think that it's not just about Haiti has to take care of itself. Yes, the country has to do its share. It has to take charge. But at the same time, I think in the international community, which has been involved in Haiti, that we need to have a serious conversation around the table and look at what's worked, what hasn't worked, and let's be innovative and let's really say that we want to have a paradigm shift in this country.
Jacqueline, stand by. We hear your passion right there. Jacqueline, Edwige was asking about the elections coming up at the end of this month. Do you see a different kind of government coming into power? Provol will be at the end of his term limit there. Is there a possibility of a change that might bring more effective governance?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, these elections today, I cannot call it. You know, it's been a stop-and-go campaign because of first cholera, then the hurricanes that was coming, that the country dodged a bullet on. And there's a lot of questions. I mean, even in terms of the candidates, in terms of how much will they be able to do, given the fact that we have the Haiti reconstruction program that's already been outlined, and so how much will they, you know, be able to make a difference? And in terms of the candidates, one of the things that we have not heard from the candidates clearly is what is their plan? Everybody knows that the problems of Haiti, you know, are, I mean, you can take to recite that to you. But the challenge is how do you as a candidate or as a president intend to tackle these problems? And I think that that is what's been lacking in the discourse, in the debate, in terms of all 19 of these candidates. And I'm not sure we're going to get that before November 28th. So I really do not know. I mean, there's a lot of hope that with this change, that there comes real, sustainable, tangible change in this country, whether it is a water policy so that, you know, you can fight this cholera epidemic, whether it is strengthening the Ministry of Health or other agencies or ministry. But, yes, there's a lot of things that need to be fixed in this country. And these elections, we're at a crossroads, and this is a pivotal moment. And I would hope that whoever becomes president, that they really start to, you know, make some changes.
Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald there in Port-au-Prince with the sirens and challenges all around her. Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us. How Edwige say adieu for the moment to your friend there.
Bye, Jacqueline. Kembela, Kembela.
Bye.
Jacqueline, thank you so much for being with us. Edwige, we just got you for a couple more minutes here. It's hard to know where to turn on this question. There will be elections. There will be a new president in Haiti. There will be, apparently, from the cholera, more trouble. Where do you look for hope for this country's future?
I look for hope in the individuals and the men and women who have always been there, who've had obstacles in the past. I always say I think people should study how Haitians have come back to and whatever measures they can after previous disasters. You know, you have these women with micro lending sometimes, with family help sometimes, who restart their businesses. Whoever becomes president of Haiti will have a huge obstacles. You have 1.5 to 1.8 million people homeless. You have the spread of the potential disaster of cholera and other infectious diseases. I mean, you have TB and other things that people can catch living so closely in such deplorable conditions. Food security, environmental degradation. Mm. I mean, we started talking about Sisyphus. I mean, this is really a Sisyphean task. And we hope that at least we'll, as Jacqueline said, we'll have a paradigm shift. We'll have a new kind of leadership that, if not, who will aggressively deal with that.
And the strength to carry on among the Haitian people? Is it there?
Yobuke, I think people are tired, but they have no choice but to go on. And we can't count on their resilience forever, but it's been remarkable so far, and it needs to be rewarded.
Let us pray for that. Edwige Dantica, her new book is Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work, and her inspiring children's book, 8 Days, A Story of Haiti. Edwige, it's always great to see you and talk with you. We wish the best for Haiti right now. We thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Edwige Dantica. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.